D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch. Heute Post-Retirement Economics von William F. Sharp. Die Stammhörerinnen und Hörer unter Ihnen wissen bereits, was heute kommt. Jeden Donnerstag senden wir Vorträge in englischer Sprache von einem Treffen der Nobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee mit jungen Nachwuchswissenschaftlern. Zurzeit übertragen wir eine Serie von der vierten Tagung der Wirtschaftspreisträger, die vom 23. bis 27. August dieses Jahres stattgefunden hat. Auf der Tagung sind 17 Redner mit mehr als 350 jungen Frauen und Männern ins Gespräch gekommen, die sich wie immer einem strengen Auswahlverfahren unterzogen haben, um überhaupt dabei sein zu dürfen. Einer der 17 Vortragenden, und der kommt heute bei uns an die Reihe, ist William Sharp, der seinen Nobelpreis 1990 erhalten hat. Sharp untersucht in seinem Vortrag Finanzstrategien für Menschen im Ruhestand. Er untersucht die Situation eines Anlegers oder Anlegerpaares auf dem Kapitalmarkt. Sein Ziel dabei besteht darin, einen sinnvollen finanziellen Rahmen für Menschen nach ihrem Arbeitsleben abzustecken. Sharp ist 1934 in Massachusetts geboren und war von 1961 bis 68 Hochschulprofessor an der University of Washington in Seattle und danach an der Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Dort ist er 1989 emeritiert worden. Den Nobelpreis bekam er wegen seiner Forschungen in der Preisbildungstheorie am Kapitalmarkt. Sharp hat seinen Vortrag, wie viele seiner Kolleginnen und Kollegen in Lindau, stark bildgestützt. Wenn Sie Hilfe bei seiner nun folgenden Rede benötigen, können Sie seine Grafiken über die Homepage lindau-nobel.org zusätzlich abrufen. Nun also Post-Retirement Economics von William F. Sharp.
Thank you. Let me say first, it's a great pleasure to be here, to get to know some of you and learn about your work. And so let me tell you a little bit about what I've been working on for a while. And it's going to be very different. The problem I want to describe is a kind of a simple problem. I'm going to use a very simple model, try to give you a sense of at least how I tend to think about it. And the problem prototypically is this. You've just retired. You have some money. And what do you do now? Do you invest it? If so, how do you invest it? If you've invested it, what is your strategy for spending it as you go through your retirement years? And, or, do you buy an annuity? And if you buy an annuity, what kind of annuity is it? For most of my talk, I'm going to use what is often used in the financial advisory business, a 30-year horizon without annuitization. Now, obviously, mortality is a very large part of this problem. At the end, I will argue that the things I've talked about can be applied in an annuity context, and that one could then mix annuitization with lack thereof. But I'm going to try to keep it very simple in both the problem formulation and in the model I'm going to be using. This is from a source that I believe is quite trustworthy. It's a graph that I found recently that I find fascinating. On the horizontal axis is wage as a percentage or a ratio of the average wage in the country in this case. And on the vertical is what's called the replacement ratio. It's the ratio of your income from, in this case, the social program in the first year after you retire to the income in the last year before you retire. And sort of the received wisdom in financial advisory business is that this should be somewhere around 70%, keep people reasonably happy with that transition and the subsequent. And what they've put together here for various countries is the relationship between your income relative to the country average before retirement and the replacement ratio. There's one outlier here, and those of you who can't read the legend, that's Italy. They have an extremely high replacement rate in the social program, and it's constant up to quite a high income level. We all know how that's working out. But I was struck when I saw this at how similar these programs are, some exceptions. But the point I want to emphasize here, if you find the 1.0 point, it's fairly far to the left, you'll see that for the average worker in each of these countries, the social program provides a replacement ratio that's somewhere around 40, 50, maybe up to 60%, but something else is needed to get you to the 70% or above. And of course, we all know in different countries, at different times, we've had different solutions to that supplement. And it's really that supplement that I'm going to be talking about, but I'm going to act as if it's the total income just to keep the description simple. This is a graph made totally redundant after the wonderful session yesterday on demographics, but it was just to remind me, to remind you, that all of these societies are getting older, that the ratio of old folks to young folks, if you use the conventional 65 as a definition, has grown, is growing, will grow, and become, you know, some of us think alarmingly large. But remember Peter's other description that if you just move that signpost forward from 65 to 70, let's say, then obviously you can at least attenuate this effect. But be that as it may, the issue of helping these people, and I'm most interested, by the way, in the people from an average wage to maybe twice an average wage. I don't care much about the people who have earned a lot of money because they can take care of themselves, and the people with very low wages will generally not have much in the way of additional savings. But there's this vast kind of middle class in all of our countries, which increasingly will have to make some of the decisions that I'm describing. And here's a graph just to emphasize that. This is the U.S. The red curve are the assets in so-called defined contribution plans, the blue in defined benefit. This came up yesterday. Defined contribution plans are plans, simply put, where the individual has to make a lot of decisions, has to decide how much to save, in which vehicles to invest. Post-retirement has to make some of the decisions we're looking at here. And in the U.S., increasingly, there still are, as you can see, defined benefit plans, which are the old types of plans in your countries and in ours, which the individual really didn't have to make any decisions. You worked, you retired, you got a check, you died, your spouse got a check, your spouse died, and then the check stopped coming. So it was basically you got an annuity, and it was a zero decision regime. But in the U.S. and increasingly in some of your countries, there are decisions to be made. And even in some of the more advanced social programs in Europe, which are in some ways ahead of ours, there are decisions to be made. Defined benefit remains in the U.S. predominantly for governmental employees. So we have this regime where people are increasingly going to have to make these, dare I say, life-threatening decisions that are financial decisions, economic decisions. And the question I want to address is, how can we, as economists, help them make sensible decisions in one institutional context or another? And I want to talk about forecasting, valuation, and something having to do with utility. And again, to go to Peter's point, I will be making a series of assumptions, all of them really quite simple, and many of them will be familiar to at least many of you. Obviously, one can make those assumptions differently. And some of those assumptions may strain credulity to the extent that I assume a complete market to obtain various kinds of values. You will have to ask yourself, well, what does that number really signify? Markets, as Myron appropriately said, are not complete, and they're certainly not complete in the sense I'm going to assume. And so the question which we can talk about is, to what extent are these valuation numbers for particular pieces of this problem interesting numbers? And we'll talk a little, and I'll wave my hands a little at the utility aspects as well. And then at the end, as I say, I'll talk about annuities briefly. So, and by the way, this is going to be discrete time, discrete space. It's going to be simulation. We're going to look at results. I have a simulator that simulates a million scenarios for multiple years because it's important in this problem, especially when you start looking at some of the extremes, to have a very rich set of scenarios in your simulation engine. So let's start. We need a capital market model, and of course we have to figure out what investments we're going to model in terms of the process. I'm going to have a very simple setting with two investments, one which I'm calling the market portfolio, which will include, in principle, all the traded liquid bonds and stocks in the world in proportion to values outstanding. So if you think about a traditional equilibrium model, such as the capital asset pricing model, which, by the way, I will not use. But if you think about that, there is this notion of an equilibrium in which the most efficient portfolio, at least in some sense, is very broadly diversified and with holdings proportionate to those outstanding. So you get it, you can sense the equilibrium notion. So that's what I have in mind. In the simulator, it's just a couple of numbers, but that's what I think of it as, and I try to calibrate the numbers to that concept. So that's the risky asset. The riskless asset is going to be something presumably riskless in real terms, because the client or the investor or the retiree reasonably cares about real or purchasing power, wealth, spending, etc. And in the U.S., we used to think that TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, were riskless real assets. Standard & Poor's has begged to differ recently about that. But you can think of something, hopefully, in your country that might play that role. Most of the results are not dependent on that. You can have the second asset have risk, at least low risk, low real risk, and most of the results that we'll look at come through, although obviously the magnitudes change. So those are my investments. Now, what I need is a rate, and to keep it simple, I'm going to assume the riskless real rate is constant for all maturities. You know, that again, that's not a crucial assumption. You can use a term structure and model it quite easily. The key thing is, what do you assume about this market portfolio? Remember, it has bonds and stocks, so when you start thinking of stock markets and the kinds of things that happened in 2007 through 2009 in world stock markets, remember, this has probably only about 50% on average in stocks. So it has a different, it has a lower risk than a stock portfolio, and it undoubtedly has a somewhat different probability distribution. But I'm going to make an assumption, to keep it very simple, about those probability distributions. By the way, when I say return, the little R's here, I mean 1.05 is an R value for 5% return. So when I say return, it's what people sometimes call total return, ending value after a year divided by beginning value. So don't let me confuse you, hopefully, any more than I have. Now, the first observation is that if you ask what will be the value of an investment after T periods, it will be the product in this portfolio. It'll be the product of the one-period returns, because returns compound over time. They're not additive. On the other hand, the log, obviously, the total value over T periods, is the sum of the logs of the returns over the periods. Now, that observation leads you very rapidly to conclude that if I ask what is the T-period return after a number of periods, if the individual returns, the R's, are drawn from independent distributions, then over a long enough period, the cumulative return, VT, will be log normally distributed, because you're adding a series of uncorrelated variates in the logs, and you get then the law of large numbers, you get the normal distribution, the usual theorem. So I'm going to say, well, let's just go further than that. Let's assume that each of the R's, the one-year return on this portfolio, is itself log normally distributed. That way, every horizon return VT will be log normally distributed. And that makes life a lot simpler. And if that bothers you, you can think, well, the one-year return is itself the product of a series of one-month or one-week returns, and maybe they have strange distributions. But if they are independently distributed, the one-year return might be close to log normal. In any event, that's what I'm going to assume. I'm going to assume that the yearly returns on this diversified portfolio in real terms are log normally distributed each year, and therefore and independent and identically distributed year to year, and therefore log normally distributed over any horizon. And this may bother lots of people, and one of the things that I'm struck with is I look at behavior in this kind of setting, be it by individuals, by endowments, by pension funds. They have strategies which can only be rationalized by either assuming that returns are negatively serially correlated year to year. That is, if it goes down in one year, it is more likely to go up the next year and vice versa, or by some very, very complex utility function. And I'll say something about that. But if you look at the long record of stock returns where we have the good data, you'll find that they, over long periods, have year to year very close to a zero serial correlation. So this is not an outrageous assumption, but it may be one which you would like to replace and could, but it'll make some of the other aspects quite a bit harder. In any event, I'm going to show you results for a riskless real rate of 1%, which is both low historically in most of our countries and high relative to the current, at least short-term real rates, certainly in the United States, and an expected return of 4.5% with a standard deviation of 10%, although remember these are not normally distributed, they're log normally distributed, but those are the parameters I'm assuming for the one-year return distribution. And to give you some sense of confidence, those are broadly consistent with historical returns, and the premium over the risk-free rate per unit of risk for this market portfolio is about a third, which is pretty consistent with a lot of assumptions made for well-diverse, highly diversified portfolios.
Post-Retirement Economics von William F. Sharp senden wir diesmal im Hörsaal. Nach nur wenigen Sekunden folgt der zweite Teil seiner Rede.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
So, let me start with, I'm only going to talk, despite what I said in the abstract, about two strategies because of time limitations. This first, which I'll describe in a few seconds, and then one towards the end, which I just made up. But I've used this apparatus to look at a number of strategies, expect and hope to look at a great many more. But I think this will give you some sense of the issues. This is a fund offered in mutual fund form, investment company shares, if you will, by one of the largest vendors of such things in the United States, and it is explicitly designed for somebody with the problem that we're looking at. And this particular one has a 30-year horizon, and it has a schedule of how much you get to withdraw and spend each year. So the first year you withdraw, 5%, I'll make, whatever the bar says, whatever the value is at the beginning of the year, then the next year you withdraw a slightly higher percentage of whatever the value is at the beginning of that year, and in the last year you spend it all. So it has this pre-specified spending rule. And by the way, this is all voluntary. You can take the money out any time. We won't assume that you do. Now, so that's the spending policy. The investment policy follows what's called a glide path. This is from the Fidelity material, in which you start out investing in a fairly aggressive portfolio, somewhat more aggressive than our market portfolio, and then over the course of the years, they gradually reduce the risk of the portfolio. And this is a very popular strategy for pre-retirement savings vehicles, where I might say that the rationalization is to cooperate and complement with human capital. Why you would ever want to do it post-retirement, I quite frankly don't know. But it turns out to be relatively harmless, as you'll see in this case. What I've done is I've created a counterpart to that strategy, which I call FIDO, which has those characteristics for my simulation. Now, I'm going to talk just a little bit and a little more later about utility functions. And obviously, we as economists love to say that the goal of an individual is to maximize his or her utility. The idea is you want to maximize utility. In financial economics, we have a whole apparatus coming from Allais' work and that of others, von Neumann, about maximizing expected utility, because financial economics, as I think you all know, is all about probability distributions. It's not about point estimates and joint, if you will, probability distributions. So if you think about a general version of this, if X1 is what you spend in year one, X2 is what you spend in year two, etc., and those are stochastic variables, then you can imagine a function that says my happiness contemplating a particular vector of spending, X1, 2, 3 through N, is F of that vector. And since there are many possible realizations of that vector, many scenarios, I'd like to maximize the expected value of that function. And importantly, that allows you, if you can formulate that function, to take into account not only what you might get in each year, but also the sequence over time. And that turns out to be an important aspect of this problem behaviorally. An alternative, a specialization, if you will, which we've used a lot in this domain, is what's called time separable, where you assume that you can evaluate and assign an expected utility to a probability distribution of outcomes in year one, and separately assign one to the probability distribution of outcomes in year two, et cetera, et cetera. And your maximan, the thing you want to maximize, is the sum of those expected utilities, time separable. That makes life much, much, much easier when you're addressing this set of issues. And I'll take advantage of that, but be prepared that many people think that real individuals care about the sequence in addition to the realizations. And I'll just sort of have glancing blows at that. All right, here's the first set of results from the simulations for this strategy. I've got to show 30 years here. I'd like to show the whole cumulative probability distribution of spending for each year, but the graphics get overwhelming, so I've arbitrarily taken points, percentiles on the probability distributions and graphed them here. The circles are the median outcomes, and what you see is that while the median, or 50-50 projection, for spending in each year is relatively flat, the range of possible spendings increases quite substantially. And again, this is not my strategy, this is FIDO, this is Fidelity's strategy. And I think, to start with, it would be interesting if the person considering that strategy at least could look at this diagram and say, is that really what I want? Am I prepared for this? And you might look at it and say, that's wonderful, or you might say, I would never countenance that. But in any event, that's what you get, at least in this model, from that strategy. Now, I mentioned the time-separable issue. This is a graph designed for people who do care about the sequence. The first graph, at least the underlying information, has all the information someone with time-separable utility needs to evaluate the strategy. But for someone who cares about the sequence, this is additional valuable information. And all this is, in each year, I take the ratio of the consumption in that year to the consumption in the prior year. So this is a year-on-year. And you see that that has quite a bit of a standard deviation, a spread in the early years, and somewhat less. Let me say something about valuation, and I'll move quickly of necessity. I'm going to use an Arrow DeBrew complete markets model, and I'm not going to tell you about these equations, but what I want to tell you is that with my assumption about IID processes for the market portfolio, if you assume that the market portfolio, as I've described it, is an efficient portfolio in a standard kind of sense, both for a one-year investor and a multi-year horizon investor, then it turns out the pricing kernel, the valuation function for all these different outcomes, is determined. And the equations sort of talk about that. It is a constant relative risk aversion pricing kernel, for those of you familiar with that, and I'll use that. So what can I do with that? Well, one thing I can do with it is this. I've plotted here the log of the state price, the Arrow DeBrew state price, for each of the million states for the 30-year horizon, the last year, on the vertical axis, and the log of the amount received or the payment in that state on the horizontal. And what you notice is, first, there is generally a relationship. Yes, you choose to consume more in the cheaper states, which makes a lot of sense, but it's not monotonic. There's a lot of noise around it. And that, if you only care if you have time-separable utility, that is inefficient. And again, this is due, I think, originally to Phil Dibvig. If I take those millions in outcomes and I sort them by magnitude of payment, and then I reassign them to the million states in turn, or sorted in terms of state price, I will get a completely monotonic relationship, and it will be cheaper, and it will have the same probability distribution. And that's what I've called cost efficiency here. And I can calculate that for anything. In this case, I've calculated it for the payments in each year, and I've used the valuation function as well. The total bar, including the green and the little teeny-weeny purple part you probably can't see in the back of the room, are the present values of the payments in each of the 30 years as of today. Now, for this strategy, it turns out I can calculate that directly from the strategy. So I don't need to assume complete markets, and I'll get the same number. But for many, if not most, strategies, you can't calculate it directly. But you can use this procedure to the extent that that's useful information. The little pink or red or purple part is the inefficiency. I can reduce the cost of that 30th year by a little bit by replacing this glide path strategy with a strategy in which the outcome is not dependent on the path that the market takes to get to the terminal point. But overall, this Fidelity strategy is, in that sense, cost efficiency, very efficient, well over 99%. So the glide path, while it disturbs many of us economists, may have some properties that are most people would be willing to pay in added cost, slightly added cost, to obtain. So let me just talk a little bit about utility functions. If you assume that the investor who chooses this strategy is maximizing expected utility and that utility is time separable, big assumptions, then you can infer what that investor's marginal utility functions must have been for each of the 30 years. And I'll just show you, and I won't do the equations, and I won't show you about optimization. You can also optimize, but it's very hard to see, but up at the top of this, there's a red curve. It's virtually a line in this log-log diagram, which is in the implied utility function, marginal utility function, for the investor choosing this strategy for year one. And the green one, which is down at the bottom, at the bottom, is his or her utility function for year 30. And what you see is they're not that different, and they also are all pretty much linear in this space. If it weren't for the glide path, if it were a constant mix, they would be linear. And so you see this as an investor with more or less the same attitude towards risk for year one and year 30. And what you see is because there is a wider range of state prices in the latter years, the investor naturally responds by taking a wider range of outcomes. And one can say more, but not in time. Here's my strategy. I mean, it's not mine. I just made it up for illustration. Here, this is each of these bars is the amount of money we put in a lockbox. So the lockbox for year 20, we put in some bonds and some stocks, and we lock it up. And in year 20, we open it, and we cash in and spend the money. Very, very simple strategy. And in this case, I have more money in the lockboxes for the early years, less in the later, because after all, there is interest in return. And in the early years, I have roughly 50% in bonds, 50% in the market, or tips in the market. And then I use a little square root rule as to how I allocate the assets in the other boxes. And I call it buy hold. It's buy and hold in some sense. And you see that the medians, again, increase a little. The range increases, but not anywhere near as much. And the year-to-year variability is relatively small. And here, I love this diagram. I adore this diagram. I find this diagram aesthetically appealing. Whether it has anything to do with investors' utilities, or I don't know. But don't you think that's beautiful? In any event, what you see, the red is the year one implied marginal utility. And what you see is the investor increasingly goes to utility function, which actually is a so-called HARA function. There's a minimum which the investor, in some sense, demands to have and then has constant relative risk aversion for the excess. Okay, I just want to wave my hands because I have 11 seconds. This was just to remind you that in many countries, especially in Germany, investors have been and are being sold products which give you, quote, upside potential. If the market goes up, you get more. Downside protection, if it goes down, you don't get less. That sounds like a wonderful thing. There are only two problems. It really costs you a lot of money, and you have to think about equilibrium properties of that pricing. And the second is there's counterparty risk. And you may have, especially those who live here, have heard about the infamous Lehman certificates, which were structured products of this sort. And it didn't turn out well. Some of these poor people, who were mostly retirees, I think they've stopped picketing, but there's still court action going on to get the money back. Annuities, this is just to illustrate. I can take the Fidelity strategy, put it in an insurance company context, and if a bunch of us get together and we're in the same age and the same sex and sort of the same health conditions, and we all want that strategy, an insurance company could provide that to us with a guarantee subject to mortality, and you can use the valuation function to find that it would cost, if it was done, taking into account overhead and other things, about two-thirds as much. So you could either spend a third of your money now and buy the annuity, or you could spend 150% as much every year till you died. Of course, your children and your charities wouldn't be pleased with that strategy. But that's basically the nature of that decision. And you can model that, if you will, although it's very forced, with different utilities for my consumption and my thinking about consumption of my children or charities. Thank you. It says zero. It's blinking. Thank you very much.
Soweit Professor William Sharp mit Post-Retirement Economics, einem Vortrag von der 4. Tagung der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee, am 25. August 2011.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.